this in the request Shabbat issue. But I must also thank the honorable member for their work ethic and commitment. It is a struggle to get members to attend the committee on Friday, but this committee is special. The members are always available when duty calls. I just want some clarity before we go to our presentation. I fully agree with you that we are not here to review decisions of the unconstitutional. But I remember that maybe we should distinguish between civil society, universities, and ourselves. Because I remember that when I was a student of law at UNISA, we had a publication called Codiculus. And the purpose of Codiculus was that law students and law teachers would read judgments and criticize judgments and make suggestions, sometimes even say they agree with the minority judgment and not with the majority judgment. And that was useful in the sense that there was a participation of the community in the development of the jurisprudence. So I want to hear you as to what is your take on that. We need your guidance as Parliament. Because when I studied law, the issue was not there. So maybe I'm talking the past. But also, we are talking progressive jurisprudence. What is progressive jurisprudence? In my view, it is a jurisprudence that must be informed by the revolutionary values that gave birth to our constitutions. But now, what guarantee do we have that all our judges have been raised in that new jurisprudence? We are also talking about setting criteria for the appointment of justice. For me, that suggests that this criteria has got to ensure that the type of judges that are appointed are judges that are alive to the need for transformation, the need for progressive jurisprudence. The other point I want to make is that sometimes we talk about common law, which is English common law. We talk about Roman Dutch law. But when we come to Africa, we talk about customary law. But common law, English common law, is about the customs of the English people. Roman Dutch law is about the customs of the Roman Dutch people. Why ours can be common law? Ours must be customary law, the others are common law. Is that not a suggestion of the inferiority of the African indigenous law? But also, the other question is, this report talks about development of common law and customary law. Now, if you look at the curriculum at the universities, African, indigenous African was not compulsory. It's not compulsory. So our judges know English common law and African customary law. Now, what qualifies them to drive the development of African customary law, indigenous African law, which they don't know? Doesn't that suggest that maybe the university curriculum should be restructured in such a way that so-called customary law is compulsory? Because if 8% of the population believe in customary law, but all our judges know nothing about customary law, how are they going to resolve the disputes affecting the people that subscribe to customary law? I'm reminded that there was a process of the universities, but you know, it is disappointing to note that lawyers are the slowest in transformation. If you look at the lawyers' organizations, they are still operating along the Bantustan line. You have Baden for black people, you have no, you have BLA, Black Nurse Association for Black People, you have then maybe with a few whites there, and then you have Lawyer for Human Rights, which is maybe in black employed there. So lawyers are moving too slow. And if lawyers are slow, it means the implementation of this constitution is slow, and therefore access to justice by the majority of the people will always lag behind. But I want to congratulate and thank the ministry for this initiative, because it will help with the discourse. You remember the department also published the document on the transformation of the judiciary. So I think these are very important initiatives. And then next time we will also request a report of the work that the universities are doing, because the universities are also lagging behind, and which means our children will be taught things that are not advancing the new constitutional disposition. So I'm really excited that at least the transformation agenda has begun. So with those general remarks aimed at creating a context also for
testimony, I need to respond. I think you've made a number of statements whilst we support the broad ambit, but you can't say judges know nothing about customary law. That's what you said. I've written it down here.
No, that said, the universities.
No, you said judges.
No,
and
no,
it is not. You need to correct yourself.
If I came across as saying that, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the universities don't make customary law compulsory. Therefore, the lawyers and judges that are produced by the universities have not necessarily all studied that.
So we need to be careful what we say, because what we say, the media are here today, and you've made a number of statements that are contestable. For example, that customary law is inferior to our common law. It is part of that. Look, you've got cases that have decided on customary law on a continual basis. So I think it's not helpful to make general statements that are not necessarily correct. Let us deal with the issues, and then we can engage in debate about these issues.
Let's start with respect. Freedom of expression, freedom of thought, and as chairperson, I want to provoke a discussion. Because you see, we come from different backgrounds. My background is that customary law is not taught in universities, or most of the universities, only common law and Roman Dutch law. So our lawyers are experts in the foreign civil laws, not the indigenous one, which is applicable to the majority of the people. So I raise that so that we can engage. I'm happy that we have started to engage, that we can engage further. Thank you.
Allow myself for the comments. I accepted your comments are general in discussions working. I don't for one moment accept that anybody who is customary law is inferior, and certainly isn't viewed as inferior in my experience in courts. You did say the judges know nothing about customary law, and I must take issue with that. I think it's an incorrect statement. And just for the record, I'm not sure where you studied law, Mr. Cech, because you keep referring to the fact that the university don't teach customary law. The university that I studied at certainly did teach customary law. And I don't regard myself an expert on it, but I certainly don't think that I know nothing about it. And I'm sure that most other lawyers are feel that. Thank you.
Listen to me, I think my learned friends are misinterpreting. It is true that it's not compulsory to do African law. In fact, customary law is not even African law. There's a lot that has been moved. African law is more than what is said to be African customary law. And most judges and most lawyers don't know African law. Even customary law is trimmed African law. It is true. And it is only accepted as long as it is not contrary to what is called good morals, which is the European way of thinking of the moral. That's true. That's true. And therefore, it is regarded as inferior to the European law.
That's true. And what we are studying is Roman art law, which is purely European law. And African law, which is accepted and understood by the majority of the African people, is not put on the same path. We need to change that. That's a fact.
Remember that the president at one meeting in UNISA did call for the African revision of the law, and Judge Shope called for the Africanization of the law, and there's a talk on the continent on the indigenization of the law. So why would such statements be made if there's no issue that must be addressed? So I think at this committee, let's exercise the fullest freedom of expression and opinion, because we need this engagement. If we don't engage even on contentious matters, we won't be contributing to the transformation of the legal system, and we need that transformation like yesterday. Honorable Majaki?
Thank you, Chair. At least it's interesting sometimes we differ, but we need to make sense of what actually makes us not to differ. Not to agree, because we need to take cognizance of the fact that we live in an open democracy. With our history that was largely influenced by bias and stereotypes that polarized women in South Africa, dehumanizing so many and marginalizing so many. And therefore, there's continued need for vigilance, because we shouldn't necessarily believe ourselves and want to believe that this just changed overnight because we happen to have a democratic constitution. And if such debates don't take place in the justice and constitutional, and of course, correctional services, but on quality, South Africa will be misguided, because when you talk about democracy, it's based on peace principles, and we ourselves sitting in the committee should be ones that manages to identify sore points, and we will continue to debate them, we'll continue to engage on them in order for us to try and harmonize the situation in South Africa, the situation that will continue to help us to come up with nation-building initiatives and efforts, because our dream of South Africa is to have a country that is reconciled, a country that has got peace, to be a society that is free and fair and is enjoyable to every citizen of this country. Coming back to the assessment of judgment of the Constitutional Court, I think it's fair to actually also look at that area. There's nothing in South Africa that shouldn't be put under scrutiny. Everything should be, and everybody should be put under scrutiny. Just for us to be in the position to understand that the business that we think we've got it together. Remember, for now, a lot of countries of the world are actually thinking that we are the best and with the best constitution. But this best constitution that we've got, it actually managed to benefit us as South Africans. So basically, when it comes to culture itself and customs, it's a broad concept, and this is why, therefore, sometimes it actually will make people hot under the collar when you talk about culture and custom and customized practices. But for me, I would actually say that we have a constitution to guide us in terms of what we call a customary practice. As long as they do not violate the constitution, then they will be acceptable in South Africa. So the Constitution is there to guide us in terms of dealing with culture. And of course, even South African culture is so diverse, which is actually also posing a much more serious challenge. Thank you, Chair.
Now, let me just conclude this part by saying that also, in line with what Honorable Majaki is saying, culture is dynamic. but people confuse customs and principles of law embedded in African law. Because even in England, you have customs and you have common law. In the Netherlands, you have customs and common law. But in our case, everything is lumped together. And people try to suggest that when we talk about African law, we are talking about Ukutwala and Ukugela. And those things happen in some parts of the country. They are not part of the law that we are talking about. But I think this was a useful engagement. We need a robust engagement because it helps us you know, identify the areas that we must deal with. I can just say, Honorable Sark and Bredenbach, that I was in the same class with Jack Nwete, Deputy Justice Senede, and there are many lawyers, judges, that I got at UNISA over a period of 10 years. I have products that are judges now. And during our time, we were ashamed to study customer law. We were ashamed to study native administration because those systems were associated with the Bantu states. So it is against that background that you have that situation where black lawyers themselves would not have studied indigenous African law because they were ashamed of studying it because of its association with South Africa. So I didn't make the statement to disparage the judges and so on. I was reflecting on a situation that we come from and saying that that background should be borne in mind. But I know that you raised this in good spirit, and that's what we want in this committee, a robust engagement. And thank you very much. Yes, yes. Well, thanks very much for that positive approach.
Thank you, Chair, Honorable Members. We are pleased to have had this opportunity to come and share with this Honorable House the project. I have introduced my colleague, I'm here with Ms. Sandy Lovelot. And we are also accompanied by one other company. There's also in attendance Mr. Advocate Gary Pina. He's from the University of Cape Town. He's one of the associate researchers in the project engaged by the Human Sciences Research Council. I'm going to give a brief overview of the project. And in the process, perhaps at the end, I'll also give comment on some of the aspects of the chair can address. But allow me to start with what the late Justice Mohammed said, to just give context to what the chair had said earlier on. And I'll just read his quote, because it is currently at the center of what is possible. Judges must consciously accept the risk that our judgments in crucial areas may be subject to vigorous attack and criticism. This should not cause them any distress. A viable and credible constructive culture evolves most effectively within the crucibility of vigorous intellectual combat and even moral examination. Rather entitled to and demand is that such criticism should be fair and informed. It must be in good faith, it must not impugn upon the dignity or bona fides, and above all, it does not impair their independence, because judges themselves would not be the only victims of such impairment. What this project, and I wanted to give that because obviously I wanted to indicate that we just wanted, there was a lot of hysteria when the project initially launched, because there was confusion between the reassessment of the impact. And I think every review process would be unconstitutional. We would not go back to 1950, where Parliament reviewed the judgment, here is set aside the judgment. But obviously, this process seeks to look into what are the judgments, what those judgments are saying in the lives of people every day, and whether they talk to a transformational agenda that the Constitution envisages. So I also realize that for this Constitution, the Constitution, differently from the interim Constitution, the Bill of Rights, binds even the judiciary and doesn't bring it in, because everybody else must be involved in the efforts to reconstruct society. This is where the comments I wanted to indicate. That we are the project that we hope that it will have a vigorous and robust debate on what the meaning and impact of those judgments are to society. Allow me, therefore, Chair, to state where the project comes from. This project was emanated from what Cabinet discussed and agreed to in November 2011. And basically, it's carried two fundamental principles that, similar to legislation policies, which are everyday debated. Jurisprudence must also be understood in the context, so that people understand what they mean to them. In fact, if the product of the free branch of state, parliament policy, legislation, judiciary process, jurisprudence, and the effective implement policy, and those aspects affect people's lives. So at any given state in life, it's important to assess and establish to what extent have people's life changed or become worse because of legislation, because of policies, because of jurisprudence. So that we should be able to see whether we have good jurisprudence or bad jurisprudence. And those who make jurisprudence will then have the opportunity to correct it. Same with Parliament. If the laws are there, they will be critical so that those who make laws will have the opportunity to correct it. Some with policies, and it comes from that perspective. It is about understanding how the highest court through judgment interpret and give meaning to laws and policies of the legislation of the branch of the state, thereby affirming the strength of the power of review and judicial activism. Judges are entrusted with a very, very enormous power of judicial review. They can set aside legislation and policy. And it is very important that the jurisprudence and present power is under scrutiny and is checked under the Constitution. It's also about checking how students contribute to law reform. And this perhaps are some of the things, of the issues that were debated before in the presentation, because judge-made law is to make sure that all laws are passed, either common law or customary law, are aligned to your constitution, and just come direct from the constitution. And such a law, especially with regard to Chapter 2 of the Constitution. The interpretation of Bill of Rights section 92 states that when interpreting any legislation and when developing common law or customary law, every court, tribunal or forum must promote the spirit, purpose and object of the Bill of Rights. That's what the Constitution requires of the courts, etc. That they have to develop, and as they develop the customs and common law, they must be guided by spirit and objective of the Bill of Rights. Now this project is going to tell us to what extent has that become a reality in the 20 years of democracy. And we talked about that it's also assessing the policies of government to ensure that the rule of law is preserved. That's around the project. As many honorable members will remember that this project emanates from education document that Chef Nevala has added to, that seeks to consider the transmission of the system and the role of the judiciary in the environmental state. A joint venture of the HRC, Human Sciences Research Complex, and the University of Fortier was appointed following an open process. An open process was with a view of allowing a competitive bid even from outside the government sector. Obviously, if the initial intention was to engage the state to do the assessment, we would have gone the open bid process. We would have called the state institution and engaged with it in a bilateral that would have produced an MOU or some sort. We went to a bid process which advertised because the idea was to get any other interest parties, whatever, who would want to escape this process, to be part of the process, so that it's not a state-driven exercise, but an open and a fair process that involves everybody. Because not government, which is looking to get this judgment, is a pool of people from diverse society. Although the project is undertaken by Investor Forte and HRC, in their team of researchers. Therefore, they have brought in a pool of experts from the diversity, from the different sectors of life. And that is to make sure that they get to every sector of society, they get to every input at all corners of the country. The study for 18 months. Chair, we also want to know that initially when we published the terms of reference, there were a lot of inputs which we received. Many people wrote to them and they said, but why are you limiting yourself to the two high courts? The crucial court is because high courts every day continue to make enormous judgment that affects people. We are going to go down to the high court. And at the time, the decision was taken by the minister that would require a lot of time, and that would also call a lot of capacity and human power, personal power to do that. And it was then decided that first phase should be limited to the two high courts, simply because the two high courts are at the center of development jurisprudence. The Supreme Court of Appeal and the Common Court makes law that comes from judges, etc. And our constitution demands that every judgment of the high court which has implicated the constitution must be taken to the Constitutional Court to be affirmed before it is given effect. So we still believe that although we could have gone through all those high courts, the two high courts will give us enough lessons to move forward to the country. They have submitted the research project, the researchers, the service providers have already submitted the first initial report by the end of March 2014, and that is a concept report or inspection report. What the report does, Chair, it gives the terms of reference, it outlines the research methodology, it indicates what angle will the research undertake, and how they are going to involve all the affected stakeholders in that assessment process. The minister is concerned the report, and it is our view that this report will be made available to Parliament once the minister gives his view and has responded to the research institution. It's a very difficult process, and we will take a sufficient time to come and present it here once it has been gone through approval processes, comments, and it has gone back to researchers. I've already indicated that there's a team of our 38 researchers from the Varasville who are doing this research, and what is also part of quality assurance. The minister, in terms of the service level agreement between the department and the service provider, will appoint a reference group. A reference group will simply look at the report and recommendations of the researchers and make their own critical views on them so that the minister can then guide them how to move forward with it. All this, the chairperson said, is to infuse within the assessment process the democratic range of each and everyone has got space to comment and to contribute the process. The Minister of the RGF is going to do the assessment and just get the judgment decision office and council assessment decision, but that is also been objective. So it has been given to the experts. There will also be a team of reference group to make sure that what comes out there has got objectivity and is something that basically will guide us and will be inclusive of all the society. The objective of the project is to locate how our jurisprudence fits within the developmental agenda of the state, and that is articulated by the National Development Plan. The National Development Plan is a roadmap towards the attainment of what the Constitution envisages at the end of the day. And when I close, I'll also make a brief reference to the National Development Plan to respond to some of the aspects that the chapter has raised. The assessment, we also look at the assessment of the capacity of the state and all spheres of government on how the assessment are implemented. Chairperson, I think there's a reality that in the recent past, where a government has had challenges in terms of the judgments of the court, not because they don't want to implement them. Government come to know of the judgment when the sheriff knocks at the door and want to come and attach the hospital, the entire hospital. If a creditor, I still wonder that if a creditor goes to court and attach the hospital, will sleep at night when nobody will have the capacity to maintain and run the hospital. People don't want the hospital, they want their money. They don't want the hospitals and the machines and the free machines, whatever. So this process is not going to help government to say, one, how do you become aware of the judgments that have been made by quite every day? to how does government plan and in a strategic way to give effect to those judgments and avoid being accused of not complying with judgment and thereby undermining the rule of law. The last point obviously is about how the judgment seems to look at the cost of litigation around this matter. Courts are a very expensive commodity. And this house has passed and everything to where the law commission, where the Southern Law Commission are still looking to how costs are being assessed in terms of curtailing costs, whatever, etc. And we are saying that to extend that this process should have, as the researchers look at the judgment, they must also look into that what measures can be put in place to make sure that justice remains affordable to ordinary people on the ground. From the concept report and approach undertaken from the terms of reference which were published by government, the assessment will focus on two main areas. One, it will assess the impact of decisions of this court. And that will do by simply collating the decisions, looking at them, asking them, looking at what were the practicalities on the ground. They will look into all the judgments from many before. And we all know, all the people, that there were good judgments, they were have the full home judgments, which could have helped people get houses at the end of the day. And we know that the reality is that there was no capacity on the side of government to implement some of the decisions. So the judgment will guide around this aspect. The assessment must be looked to extend South Africa's evolving jurisprudence has transformed and developed the common law and customary law in line with the constitution. The reality is that unlike government and parliament, the court can only rule where the matter is brought to the court. So when an African woman would not go to court complain that I cannot inherit because in terms of customary law of marriages, the inherit my son is the one who's the heir to my estate. The court would not have put in the bare judgment. Where the bare judgment was somebody went to court. Where the criminal judgment that abolished corporal punishment was somebody went to court. The death sentence was abolished because there was never a case before court. So the court must seize of this matter so that it should really be able to achieve the aspect. So it is also a role that parliament and government must play to complement the role of the court, so that people should not wait to go to court, but they should have transmitted by gender by the civil council state or go simultaneously. The second pillar of the research is to conduct a study on the implementation of the decisions of the Concord and Supreme Court committees due to address one, progress made and challenges encountered in the implementation of this type of decision. The challenges raised and whatever could impact on the students itself. So that will go, we'll come with a feedback to the judges. I don't think the judges come here to when they make judgments but they're not being followed. So the person will also look at what are the challenges that causes judgment not to be followed after the latter end. It will also look into legislation pieces of government that have been put in place to give effect to these decisions. And that's the first one they have raised. If a court rules on a particular matter, it's expected of government to make law to accept that matter. Because although the court rules in respect of the parties before it, the effect of the judgment is the development of the jurisprudence, which must be filtered through other means. And that will allow government and all those who have the responsibility of giving effect to those judgments to start the necessary legislation process. It's also look at the capacity of the state to realize the outcomes and decisions by the judgments. I already talked about the capacity assessment. The third pillar of the research is to look at the direct claim to crucial court. Okay, I thought about the issue of cost. Every crucial court was established as a court of equity, which could have helped and championed the transparency court. But we all know that most of the cases go to court either because somebody got money loaded in the pocket or the public interest matter where somebody else can pick it up, whether it's cars or whether it's universal center. Otherwise, nobody can on his own go up to a cultural court, etc. So this study must help us how at the end of the day the court becomes the people's court rather than become an elite which can only be filled by a few. And that must look into the rules of the court of evidence. Is there anything that stops people from going into the Federal Constitutional Court and ask that and have the action? Will they change that way? To be under the mask, go and get a senior counsel who charges $75,000 on the day, etc. And all those aspects will teach us how we want to move forward in terms of these aspects. The fourth point is what it's about, and it got nothing to do. I want to say it has nothing to do with independence of the judiciary. Court performance and output is a better everybody is going to direct interest in. The speed within which cases are finalized. It's a matter of parliament and the executive and the civil society have got interest in it. It is necessary that the Chief Justice has initiated measures to create a modern case flow management system. So that case has a fast track system. When people go to court and have a judgment and the person demands that first trial should ensure that they get justice speedily. And the research should help us understand why our cases dragging. It's because our capacity, we've got few numbers of judges. Or it's because we've got few courts who have been dispersed. Or it's because we don't have other mechanisms like the appeal students where matters are resolved through all these dispute resolutions. Must everything else go to the court? And all those things are things that we must struggle with, and they form part of the transformation agenda and the constitution. Now I've talked about the national development plan. And before I make specific reference to the aspects that show on the slide, I want to read one paragraph on the NDP that talks exactly to the progressive jurisprudence. And the NDP was also a consultative process which included the judiciary. Although the Constitution stipulates several criteria for the appointment of judicial officers, it is important for the JSC to elaborate further guiding principles to build consensus on the qualities and attributes of the ideas of African judge. The criteria should include a progressive philosophy and an understanding of the socio-economic context in which the law is interpreted and enforced. While the JSC has published a broad list of criteria for judicial appointments in September 2010, they require development and a clear understanding of their meaning and application. That's what the NDP says. These judges that inhabit our own environment. But judges who inhabit the environment as they apply it in the US and Germany, where the circumstances are different, where they've got no housing problems regarding to housing, health, and social status, whatever. We need judgments that talk to the head on the ground, and that's what the NDP says. And that can be achieved if the jurisprudence, if they're achieved, will build and improve and enhance our jurisprudence, and will take this country forward in terms of its developmental agenda. Now, other than what is stated, the NDP focuses on the following in relation to the judiciary specifically, elevating inequality and poverty. And the social rights and the rights are intended exactly for that. Because for that reason, the discounts went ahead of all known renowned democracies and made the social rights justiciable, that people can go to court and demand water. No one else is happening, except Central Kenya, of course, because it came after us, and they came from us, of course. But South Africa was the first to be very courageous to put the court at the helm of ensuring that the rights in the Bill of Rights are given life and issued. And the judgments that talk about are several, and this process is going to help us. How can those judgments add value to the transformation agenda of the people forward? Secondly, the NDP focuses on building a capable state and decides the capacity gaps needed to implement the cause for advancement of the rule of law. Thirdly, the looks at strengthening judicial governance. The debate here about whether we need an independent judicial pressure isn't the NDP. That's why they're sort of coming here to this committee, to indicate how he is going to put that process in place, because in terms of the vision 2030, that must come into vision. And as a society and inside the country, jurisprudence have got a very important element of ensuring that all actions of social cohesion and coexistence are given as two. I would have then the next one is the methodology I talked about it. The team of the methodology, but importantly in summary, the methodology is both desktop focused, but it's also empirical. They will go to people and they will engage with those people affected by the issue. And they will go and engage with the people who implement the issue. They will talk to judges. They will talk to government bureaucrats. They will talk to people on the ground so that they come with a clear understanding of what should be done for judgment or for the students to be invested to the system. And those are across all those things, across the issue of direct access to concord, across the issue of common law and customary law, upon the issue of jurisprudence itself. They will get experience of the people so they can make a clear articulation of what they mean alive. We'll send a dossier of judgments already identified. And those judgments in this 91-page document are judgments which the researcher will go through them to come with to their conclusion. And when we come here in a month or two, we'll be able to tell this committee how those judgments have been analyzed and what are the lessons that can be performed from those judgments. It's a clear process that wants space and time. And I'm emphasizing this because at the end of the presentation, I'm going to try to show what the cost of the process is and what the value is that we are going to get out of the exercise. It's not money into the space. I've mentioned some few cases, and I'm just mentioning in passing, Chair, because we still give a detailed account of those cases. I've talked about customary law cases, the basis is we know that I should one case of citizenship, etc. All those are just things that are coming up. And what are the issues of this? Are they qualifying customary law? What should we lose judgment? Should we go back and do it and put it in a manner that customary law won't qualify? Those are the lessons that we must understand as we move forward. Talking for today, Chair, there was a colloquium held by the stakeholders. I want to emphasize, government is not involved in the risk assessment process. Government was consulted like anyone else to give its opinion. So we had the opportunity of being invited during February when they conducted the colloquium. And judges, and even judges of the colloquium, but retired judges were part of the colloquium. And shared their views, introduced how they've seen their jurisprudence evolving while they were there, and their facilities. And that was very, very enlightening and very enriching because we had to understand more than what we read on paper. And I've already said that in March there was an inspection report, and I've talked about the inspection and inspection report, articulate the methodology, the process and timeline. We anticipate a midterm report by the end of this month. And that's the report that we said will come and share with the minister asked that detailed report cabinet because this process emanates from a cabinet decision. So it will be probably the Minister of Women's and Peace Cabinet half hour into the process. And thereafter, we'll then come to this house to indicate what the plans are from the medium report. As part of our moving forward is that this process for the first time, Chair, will provide a platform for public discourse and judgment. Because judgments are the least of the things that are talked about in society. In fact, it's so much that's not talked about. I was given an example to ESCO when I was in this case yesterday. I said, hey, you go to court with an advocate. You attend court for 5 weeks. The judgment is delivered. You leave the court room with advocate. You don't have the judgment. It was pronounced to you. After 5 weeks, you get the judgment. You must go and buy it from computer. It's not a judgment. You went to court because you want a judgment. But you don't have the proper judgment. The attorney tells you outside the door and says, look, it's 3 years and we'll bring you to the prison or we're discharged, and that's the end of the matter. Now this process should help us how people should access judgment. Should we not have our own website of the court where people can go there after the judgment? I was amazed how the hearing instead of the Falun Commission become available to the 5 hours after people have testified. But we cannot get judgment if the people are affected. And government must go and pay license fee to access them through the license mechanism. And that's accepted by us, and that's produced by the judges. But nobody got access to those judgments. That's accepted by those who show them back to us. And those are things we must look at as part of this process. The cost. I know because what will be interested in the cost. He asked me, he said, where do you get the money to receive? The project has been, the bid was awarded at a cost of 10.3 million. And that implies that the project will be implemented over two financial years, which obviously make sure that one part is payable this financial year, the other part is payable this financial year, based on the supply chain management perspective. A civil development has been put in place, properly vetted by the attorney, by state attorney, in terms of which the project is managed. And our union department manages the project. And my colleagues say they manage that project on a day-to-day basis. And I wanted to say, if we engage private institutions, the way we've anticipated them to get involved, we have paid far more than that, what they have mentioned here, etc. We have paid this kind of money because we are engaging the state entity. And they also see value for themselves. They also want to enhance their research reputation so that they should be able to be recognized as a credible research institution having undertaken this complex assessment, etc. And the skills remain in government. We are not getting a consultant to come take 10 million and go with the money, must go there and buy the report. The report will come to Parliament by those institutions, and they will also come available. And they will come available all the time. And therefore, we still, it's our view that the outcomes and the value that this project yields to society is tremendous. We can't quantify 10 million. It goes down to what people's experience are on the ground. It goes down to customs law. It goes down to your cost. It goes down in giving people experience on how to move forward in this process. Having said that, we anticipate therefore that out of this process, we should then be able to get better guidance from this house on how we continue with the process. And this is kind of a brief overview of the project, Chair. And I think I and my colleague would be able to engage with whatever comments or questions that Parliament may be. I just wanted to say that in conclusion, that when we presented this project at our own ex-community department, they also were, the big was as vibrant as they were today, as I before started. And many comments and views have come up. And some of our principals have said, instead, is now that we realize that many aspects would have been added to the project. Because obviously, 20 years down the line, it's still very appalling that we have not resolved the issue of language in the court. That despite the fact that judgment is given to people, the whole mechanism and process unfolds in a manner that still falls into people, etc. And those things are very essential to the public trust in the justice system. And I hope that through this process, government and the department in particular will be able to accelerate some of the transformation gaps that are still between the system. Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the opportunity.
Honourable members, I think this is a high level preparation and presentation which shows respect for this committee. Advocate, we want to thank you for that. Because sometimes documents are thrown to us with the wishy-washy comments and that level of preparation is very, very helpful. You know, I just want to make some observations to assist the committee to engage. You know, generally we say that African cultures are diverse and they make things difficult to handle. But all these African people are Bantu people and their language is said to come from an Ur-Bantu, which means the mother language of all the African languages is the same. And that's why you find that if you talk about Ubuntu, then the others will say Ubuntu. Then Google, Zeus will say Ubuntu, the Sotho will say Ubuntu, the Swahili people will say Ubuntu, it's the same thing. And therefore, if you take into account the fact that even the churches today accept Ubuntu philosophy, you can say that the greatest contribution that African culture can make to jurisprudence is that of infusing Ubuntu philosophy across. So I want to think that we must address that issue, because we should not be pushed to say no African things are very diverse and therefore they are not workable and so on. But also, you read a section of the Constitution which talks about interpretation, which must take customary law into account. Now, if the Constitution itself wants customary law to be addressed, and the university's curriculum don't make customary law a compulsory course, wouldn't that affect the negatively the interpretation of the Constitution? The other point is, you know, this is an important process. Now, doesn't it offer us an opportunity to ensure participation of black students and young academics, so that at the end of the process, you have developed skills in the historically disadvantaged communities? To what extent has that been done? Can we also be favored with a list of who are in this project? And the reference group is a good idea. Is there any provision for community participation? But you refer to it, if we could just be told how is this structured. But you see also, when we deal with jurisprudence, Western jurisprudence is based on individualism, and African jurisprudence is based on communalism. Now, if I marry 10 women, we build an estate, and one of the 10 women divorces, how do I divide the estate? Because it's a communal estate. We are many, and one says divide into half. Which half? How do you determine half? So those are the things that we must look at. And now you raised an interesting thing about locking up the hospitals. Now, that raises the question of Ubuntu, because Ubuntu would not allow you to close down the hospitals when people are sick, they are dying. And how do we address that? Is that not an issue of essential services, that essential services should have an impact on the jurisprudence? You know, I attended a meeting in KZN. They brought all traditional women and everybody. They were discussing virginity testing. The women were saying in Zulu, the Constitution did not give birth to children. We gave birth to children. We're going to do what is in the best interest of the children. I'm not saying that is good, but it shows you that if you deal with people and apply law to them without understanding them, you can delegitimize the law, and the people defy the law. And I think we should guard against that. You know, I always appreciated the work that CALS did, the Center for Applied Legal Studies at VEST, and Legal Resources Center. But I was involved in a project of the Department of Land Affairs, which had to deal with this legislation called CLARA. And the differences in CLARA reflected the differences of world views. And the problems of having people prophesying in a process involving a legal system they don't understand. So I'm trying to say that one of the issues we must debate is that we are South Africans. We can't have two South Africans. If you have two South Africans and have the one South African presiding over the other without knowing the other, then we are going to create problems for magistrate justice. But also you have raised the question of public interest law or community justice. We have grappled with that question when we dealt with the legal aid bill. I remember you even promised us a document on that. I think it's something that we should pursue. Lastly, you know, during the struggle we were talking about contextual theology, because people realize that people, when they come from Europe or Asia, they interpret religion against the background of the culture. And similarly in law, there's a tendency to interpret the law against the Western culture. And then that starts to distort the law and the philosophy. But I'm happy you raised that. I think we must talk about contextual interpretation of the Constitution and the law, and I think you have articulated that very well. And lastly, the question of access to judgment. You know, clients do not necessarily agree with what the lawyers put on their glove on or with the judgment. So if you don't give aggrieved people a copy of the judgment for them to read and make up their own mind, how do they then have direct access to court, because they don't even have a copy of the judgment? They just hear a story from the lawyer who sometimes doesn't even speak their language. Maybe they don't even understand what the lawyer is saying about that. Now, how do we have a legal system where the majority of lawyers don't understand the languages of the people to whom the law applies? Shouldn't we say that universities must make this so-called customary law compulsory, that lawyers must at least compulsorily take one indigenous law, so that we are sure that there's access to common understanding? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay, and thank you for the for your broad presentation today. Jay, when we were in the previous committee, we from the ACDP side did express our concerns about the process, and I think those were initial stages when there's a lot of confusion, and I think you've clarified at that stage there's a lot of concern about a review taking place, where we are talking about an assessment. We are slightly more at ease with what you have presented, and the process we see is much broader, and we welcome a number of the aspects that you are looking into, and particularly your emphasis on the protection of the independence of the judiciary. I think that is a given, it's a constitutional given that we need to be aware of at all stages. I did express concerns about the budget to you before the meeting, and I said, because the initial amount last year was 2.5 million that was approved, and now it is 10.3 million, but we do appreciate that the mandate is much broader now. I think the initial mandate was only the Constitutional Court, it's now the NCA, is looking at various other aspects which we think is beneficial. Whilst looking at the jurisprudence, I think it's also very important to look into the implementation of the court decisions by government. And I think that is something that is crucial, and we welcome that. One of the points is, I'm a bit unsure about, is the number of cases. You've given us 100 pages of cases, and I'd like to just touch on what the chairperson said about the impact of religion on society as well, and jurisprudence. And if you, and I'm talking about broad religion, African indigenous, Christianity, Muslims, whether that is a point that you'll also be looking into, because obviously a large majority of South Africans hold to a certain religion, and I would like us to consider that as well. But you give us 10 landmark cases with certain clusters. How does that tie in with the 100 or the 100-page document that you've given us as well? We need to have an appreciation of how they're going to work together, because obviously under those 10 clusters that are on page 12 of your document, health, education, hygiene, water, customary law, obviously, for example, crime is not there, but you will be dealing with crime under the broader case assessment. So if you could just give us a better understanding of how that will work out. Chair, yes, we in South Africa, I think the progressive realization of socioeconomic rights is a huge, huge positive constitutional element. And I fully appreciate what the Chair also said about, we had an interesting, robust debate at the beginning, but we do respect one another's views, Jay, definitely. And I do understand the issue of indigenous law, and I think as we speak more, we will have a clear understanding even of the difference between customary law and indigenous law. And it's something that we from our side will be definitely looking into, but we do see as part of this assessment, which we also appreciate. So Chair, just those few comments from our side. I just want to say that it does seem that the budget is warranted because of the amount of work to be done now. My concern is, will you be able to do it in the time frame? Because we're talking about an 18-month time frame. We're speaking about an interim report that must be given by the end of October. Is that on track? And I think March next year, the final report. And I know that there were concerns expressed about the time constraint. And is there a possibility then that if it goes longer, that the budget is going to have to increase? But we do see value in this assessment. It just all depends then what one does with that assessment, where we'll be watching very closely to ensure that the independence of the judiciary, and I'm sure everyone agrees with that, is not negatively impacted by any actually at the end of the process. There's going to be a conference which we also support, but what comes out of that, we must ensure that the independence of the judiciary is upheld. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Smith, Honourable Mailan, and Honourable Kumlana, Honourable Majake.
Thank you, Professor. And maybe let me welcome the presentation, which was very eye-opening. Chairperson, I think this is a very exciting project, very exciting. I think it has the potential of making us realize the transformation of the legal system, as it is what we are fighting for. No, Chairperson, it is a fact that the access to the Constitutional Court at the present time depends on the amount of money that you have, because it's not everybody who can be able to access the Constitutional Court. Now, I'm thinking if it was possible that the Constitutional Court could be accessed by individuals, interest groups, and whole communities, and if the judgments could be adhered to, this could have an impact on lessening the amount of service delivery protests that we see every day. And I think this can take it for South Africa forward. Well, thanks, Chairman. Those are just my few comments.
Thank you, Mr.
Yeah, I just want to echo my colleague's appreciation for the work to be done and done. I just wanted to point on two things. I think I won't agree with the Chairperson's remarks on the approach. I also want to warn against taking the so-called customary law as written or approved by the European Court's area. Just give one example, which ended up in the misinterpretation in the BFH, for example. The in terms of the African law, way of doing things, it's not because it's not inherent. The man there is a trustee of the property, or communal property of the property. And yet now, in terms of the so-called customary law, he inherits, because according to European way of doing things, marriage is for, it's associated with wealth, you know, you have hard wealth, it's common wealth of both husband or married in commit to a property. This is property. In the Afghan way, it's communal. The property belongs to the family. So because the girl is going to get married, go to another home, be in another home, then it's the boy who is expected to be in the family. And because now the judges now looked at the customary law as they wrote it, and it is talking as you inherit. So then they said, no, you can't inherit. Girl must not inherit.
they put it as if now it's discrimination against women. And they said, and this feminist always say that, it's African law against women or something. So, I don't know. I only hope that you will go further than the so-called customary law, which I said is not African law, and find out deeper what exactly is important. Secondly, another example is the question of access to courts. The courts, as we understand it, are business. There are even business people who are involved in it, court lawyers. And they go to school and read so that they effective their law and they get money from it. Whereas the African system, courts are for everybody. I mean, it's a free thing. You have, it's free for you to go to get just access to courts. But I don't know how you're going to interpret that. I was going to say that I was, I'm encouraged by your proposal that there should be some access to constitutional courts or even higher courts. I don't know. Those are the two of my friends. Thank you.
Thank you, Advocate. Honorable Majake.
Thank you, Chair. Just to welcome the report, Mr. Sahab. And today that we appreciate the progress that has been made, and we are hoping that we will see see the process being taken through, so it can be concluded that we can therefore be in a position to manage to benefit from the objectives of the assessment itself. The question I want to ask is, who leads the process? Because you're saying that the process emanated from the cabinet memo, and for now you're reporting, and somehow, I don't know whether already this has been presented to cabinet. I'm just looking at logistical arrangements and ownership of the document, because that has got implications in terms of pushing the process forward once you've actually concluded the process. So we need to actually be clear to who leads the process. And indeed, I do support the judgment, that is, the judgment must really be available once the judgment is made in the court of law, and to have some companies out of court, outside the court, be the ones that actually own the judgments, and the public having to buy those documents. I don't think it's really a fair process that we're actually going in place for South Africans. I think you actually also were making some suggestion that with the submissions that you received, there were sentiments to indicate that maybe you actually also need to include the High Court. And I am of the opinion that maybe the High Court needs to include it, especially because you've actually alluded to the fact that every judgment of the High Court that has got constitutional re-implication must be taken to the Concord. So these processes are connected, and why not at the time of assessment, just do an overall assessment rather than have to, at some stage, go back to when you High Court judgment assessments. In terms of the categories, I would like to actually just emphasize the fact that it's very important for you to take care of the category for women in terms of the judgments and how they actually relate to advancement of the status of women in South Africa, so that at the end of the process we can be in the position to really understand what extent judgments in this court are actually helping to empower women. So many sentiments have been expressed that relates directly to women. You talk about inheritance, for example, it's an area that impacts on the lives of women and their children, and especially the rare matter that you actually quoted. It actually had precedence in terms of inheritance for girl children, because they're actually being discriminated, and the constitutional potentiality came up with a groundbreaking judgment that actually gave the inheritance to the girl children. We are in a constitutional democracy, and we should actually understand also, even if there is customary law should be such that it does not discriminate on women and children, and that's why we had to do the primogeniture rule that was in the administration. act. And also with the things I think Saint Mentor will equate to marriages and customary marriages. Customary marriages that used to be unfair to women, which we find today to be the kind of marriage that actually has been changed to help to empower women and children who find themselves in this arrangement through the Customary Marriages Act. It goes to the question that was actually asked by Comrade Matholi. Because for now, what is important is just choice. Does a woman want to be in this relationship? And choice is actually connected to the Women's Charter of Effective Equality. That actually was utilized long before as an instrument for empowerment of women. And it also impacts on issues of reproductive rights. Because today, unlike in the past, termination of pregnancies allowed and this could actually are for and are against. But the one important thing is choice. Does a woman want to actually terminate? And termination would be for who you are, your culture, tradition, and practices. If they don't allow it, you don't do it. A woman has got valid reasons why they want to terminate pregnancy. Circumstances probably that surrounded the pregnancy. Maybe she does a rape or something like that. So, but the point that I'm making is that also we need to look at the area of women. To what extent are all these judgments really taking into consideration all those important factors that has got to do with the advancement of the issues of women in South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me join my colleagues by appreciating the presentation by the department. And also comment on the following issues, Chairperson. Issue of access, JB, is very, very critical, especially to rural communities, traditional communities. Also in this presentation, I saw somewhere where mention is made of indigent and unrepresented people. That is very, very, very critical, especially to our rural women there in rural areas. It's very, very critical because they've got very, very contentious issues which I think need to be addressed. Therefore, I think this project is a very, very vital one in that regard. And again, let me come to issue of these 10 landmark cases. Then, as much as I appreciate the cases selected, so I don't know which criteria we use in selecting only the cases, because if you made mention of Shiluvani case, and then there is Mujaji versus Mayelani case and other very critical cases, especially when regarding the customary law, or in terms of recognition of customary law act. And issue of language, the chairperson did touch on the language issue. Language is very, very critical when coming to our courts. Because in most cases, we find that what is used there is foreign to our people. Not foreign in the sense that Latino, the Meromoto, the Mosotalandis, and so forth. You know. So in the process, our ordinary people and people in general get lost in there. So maybe if the language issue also is being considered. For an example, in Mogalakwena, the then Bosphorus, language they call is African. Even if you are an attorney, not so well conversant in African, you are compelled to go to the shepherds and negotiate a way out. So I think these are very, very critical issues which need to be looked into. When coming to our recommendation, yes, we know the project and progress made, and again, we think that through this input which the committee shall have made, this will enhance the process further. Thank you, Chair.
Progressive realization of socioeconomic rights. Because the choice of the word progress is important, because if you go to Swaziland, for instance, other African states, which whose budget depends on donor funding, and a court goes and orders them to provide the houses for 1 million people. And the budget required for that is 10 times the budget of the whole country. It's still that justice. Now, in South Africa, I think you correctly say that we are leading in that jurisprudence. But if the court goes and orders a municipality which is not viable, which cannot even pay salaries, to provide houses or land which is in the hands of a capitalist, and they have to buy the land, the people who hears about that favorable judgment are going to demand that the houses be built, and there's no budget for it. And then they start building schools and clinics and so on. So how do we manage, for instance, such a situation? So I'm just saying that what the Honorable Swart raises about progressive realization should be on the agenda of the debate. And then Mr. Honorable Maila also raises this important question of actually, whilst we implement human rights, that can be counterproductive, because then people can, this can lead to savings development project, the protest. So I think that legal human rights education must actually be a top priority. Because some people say only 46% or less of our people understand this constitution and how it operates, and they see in it just rights. Whether there's a budget for the realization of those rights, it doesn't matter. They want their rights. At the end, we can have a situation where the implementation of the constitution destroys the constitution itself. So I think we need as our Honorable Sartre was saying, a real discourse and so on. You know, for instance, this question Bumugan raised, but in the Western sense, we talk about ownership. That's why we have community of property. But in the African case, we have trusteeship. So when you say estate goes to the son, he doesn't own it, he's a trustee of the commonwealth of the family. And when we discuss jurisprudence, we need also to address that and say, how does that concept of the law affect the transformation? Honorable Mazake raised a very important issue of categories. You know, I think with regard to women, who are the most vulnerable, women and children who are the most vulnerable here, the problem is who speaks for the women, because you go to some parts of the country where they practice some offensive things, and then the women from Johannesburg and Cape Town will say, this thing must not be done, it's against women's rights. The affected women say, no, this is our rights. Isn't it therefore important that traditional communities and traditional women be given space to talk about this matter, that we don't get researchers from universities speaking on behalf of these women? I was talking to one woman from Venda this morning. I visited their house. She's the top chief director in government. Now I sit with the father. When she comes there, she kneels down, she lies on the floor. I say, but what do you do there? She says, no, I separate my education and what I do at work with my socialization and the respect that I will give to my father and my father's visited. But the researchers will say this is oppression of men. They are made to lie down. So those things must not only be debated by experts. The men affected must be involved in that debate. But I must thank you because you have raised critical issues which are going to inform the transformation agenda and all of us. And lastly also, you see the case of Shiluan. Africans have what we call blue blood or royal blood. Now, when you succeed as a chief, you must have the blue blood. But when a woman succeeds as a chief or a queen, and she is married to someone outside the people who produce the royal blood, it means the kingship is going to move into another family where it does not belong. If I can give you an example of where I come from, you have the royal blood because the queens are the intermediaries between the royal ancestors and God. It's part of religion. Now, if our queen is going to be fathered by someone from Mozambique or Zimbabwe, then you break the link between the queenship and the royal ancestry and God. So it then violates religious rights. So that's why Honorable Mpumelelo was saying that sometimes our judges will use a customary law as it was understood by the old system and distorted. So this, I think, is going to make a very, as Honorable Maja said, a very interesting discourse. And I think we must all approach this with open mind. You know, we want to create socially cohesive communities, and to do that we must be open. I think we'll find a solution somewhere down the line. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I've noted all the comments that have been raised, and as I've said initially, I will convey them to the session because they are very valuable. And on the issue of the 10 cases, it's different because I raised it with the medical lawyer, and we wanted to avoid a process where we would come with an academic assessment of the landmark judgment that means nothing in terms of jurisprudence and in terms of people. The initial 10 cases I listed were the cases that came out of that discourse, the colloquium. And the list I sent yesterday, an updated list of what the team has come up to look with. And I think there is an appreciation that is emerging that the focus should not be on the most cases we have been talking about, but the focus should be on the judgment that have got a transformative element in themselves, so that they will be able to assist. What should we do? Because there are many, many judgments which are not going through the media whatever, which change people's lives and which not get to know and get implemented. Because nobody knows about it. We know about substance and bad and everything. And it's easy for those cases. But the ones on the cracks are the ones that the people, and it was in this context that was a suggestion that go to high court, because that's where I want to lose most of the cracks. But we'll take this debate back to them. The other comment I wanted to make here, as I said, I'm not going to go through all the comments. I'm just making three comments as we conclude. You raise a very important question, that how is this process going to be publicized for the older people on the ground, the universities, whatever, etc. And that's the point you have raised. The minister has started a program where he will be going to universities and engaging with the law students, and starting at the University of Limpopo on the 18th. And the part of the proposal is to let students get involved in this process. I have to understand that why where to do countries. You pay people who do not research, not vice versa, because they do the same research that government would be paid to have it done. It's done by poor college professors. And Sweden and Denmark, they appreciate people who come with this research. So that's what we want to do. We want to go to the postgraduate students so that those students can engage with their research. This is their idea must not come with a good sense of who's going to let you need a library and nobody read. The idea is to produce work. And it's going to say here, when government, when parliament debates this legislation, the must have a sense of legislation to a subject matter, whether of a savage environment contacting with the rural women and children. That's not the purpose of the legislation. It's not to line up libraries, which is only accessible to those who go to UNIS, etc. And that's why we set this project to unpack, and it's going to lead to how judgment becomes available at the end of the day, because it should not be a commodity of the elite, or those who can only use it for purpose of different species, whatever. And the people who are affected by those judgment have got no knowledge, no clue, no benefit for the judgment. I will convey the issue pertaining to the language to languages, and also the issue pertaining to religion. The good thing about it, I think SLA in terms of reference has clearly indicated the opportunity to revise or to whatever to adapt whatever is done with the research. And I think whatever the opportunity, either go and wait and start a new process and a new big process, whatever, we should see to what extent can we just adapt within the current arrangement so that the people who are already in the car, they are able to look into that, and we'll look into that, and I think the interim report will help us move forward with the speed, etc. And coming back to whether it's a result of extension or whatever, and if I come to that, I wanted to just to explain how what Maraga said in terms of who owns the process and document. Firstly, this was a cabinet approved process which was factored into our program as a department, and therefore should form part of the APP, which is the parliament as of oversight. So everybody will have an input. That's why I present here, because it's part of what governments would get budget about. So we need to come into both here and the outcomes. The ultimate outcome of the process is to develop a program of action that will assist government departments, and that will be shared with the judiciary, or not to improve justice. I spoke to one judge earlier when I was in a judgment in the EU. We have a prison system in South Africa where courts rely on the previous judgment, and they will come and tell you his judgment was delivered in 1940 and it will have to be overruled. And that was overruled by the constitution. You don't have to take it back to court to overrule it. So when they look at precedent, they must look at the precedent which is in the constitution. If that judgment is in line with what the appellate division ruled in 1933, and there's not been any judgment, we are going to regret in terms of it. And that is progressive experience. Exactly. And if it's not understood, if your education doesn't bring that articulation mindset on the new crop of judges, we'll get judges who will rely on the old jurisprudence that does not take the case forward, and the danger of that is all magistrate courts are bound by the jurisprudence. The magistrate will be forced to give that standard approach, even if the magistrate does not agree with it. And these are the things that form of action will go and share with the judges, so that they should find a way of how they develop jurisprudence from old jurisprudence that still exists. I noted the comments by Honorable Mpumula, and that's very true. The challenge is that customary law, HR law, is written by people who never practice the system. They will then interview those who practice and holding their books, and unfortunately, because of the legislation, those who interview did not come and validate. So if they can hold them, produce the book, etc., the people who contributed to the book would not have had the opportunity today, but what you said, not what I sought to convey at the end of the day. And we must, and that's the message, one of them from this project, we must encourage young jurists to write and develop them. You can only develop customary law and judicial law if there is a research and writing from those who are universities, and we'll encourage them to engage with this process. I've addressed the issue of Honorable Mutabu in terms of the judgment, and we'll turn it back to them so that the judgments are judgments that are going to add various processes, etc. And I think the third report will deal into them. Similar to the issue of language. and also the issue of Honourable Swart in terms of progressive realization of this process. It will be taken into account. This is a very dynamic process because, as I said, while we were the first country to be characterized in terms of coming to a very revolutionary constitution that gives the court the right to change the financial, how judges exercise that within the context of judicial activism is going to be the crucial at the end of the day. And as I said, I will keep saying, if you read the judgment of Subramani, if you read the judgment of Woodbomb, you have to, the judge must understand that theirs is not to step in the shoes of the collective and allocate the budget. Because that will be running against the spirit of the constitution. They must look into the rationality. Whether the one who is voted with the power to make laws, he or she did the functionary articulate a rational basis for the law. And not go there and change and make law for legislation. And not go there and change policing and order where house must be built. That's not our space. But because we have a new jurisprudence and for the new innovation, where we don't have precedent, this process is going to help us identify where they've made faults, where they've faults are. So that we must go and correct it. As I've said, the government, parliament correct mistakes when they realize that law is not working. It can't be possible. But what is the judgment is not working? You can't be with it. You can't go back to them and be changed. Because you'll be acting contrary to your law if you don't implement it. That's why part of the project is to investigate the challenges relating to the implementation. If it's a decision which cannot be implemented under the sun, it must find its way to be corrected. And we share the outcome with the judiciary. The Supreme Court unfortunately provides a mechanism where High Court can engage with decisions made in the past, etc. And I know that they will be limited by principle of that they have already made a judgment. But we have to find ways of how to dispute them that appears not to be progressive, that seems to take us back. And all these are lessons that will come from this process and we share with the judges and the judiciary so that together we can come with solutions that will help us come with a agenda to realize the objective of the project. So as I said, I take a note of all the questions and the comments, and we will convey that to the researchers. The reference group is in the process of being selected for appointment, and as you said, we are looking really as people who are outside the government entity who will come with our own independent thinking in mind so that they could advise us. It will not help if we get people who already got a particular view on the process to give a view on the process. We will come and give comment in terms of progress. Once we are going to cabinet in October, we should be able to give the report, share the report with the political committee. Thank you, Chair. I may not have answered all the questions, but I've taken most as comments and concerns that will channel appropriately.
Yes. Mr. Kosana, I think you must be the volunteer-in-chief, go to Justice College and give lectures there. And that before the end of this term, you must have written a book on constitutionalism and be a role model for the students that you are asking to write. Finally, I just wanted to know whether it would not be useful. I welcome the idea that the minister is going to invest. Whether it would not be useful that there are preliminary reports. And then we get that preliminary reports into forums of women, students, civil society. So that before the final report is produced, there's an input from the community. So that we don't end up with something that only comes from the experts. But also, social scientists, whether we can find a way of involving social scientists, because those would have the expertise to look at the impact on society. But also something that is not within your power. You know, I studied at UNISA,
I got a doctorate there, of Doctor of Laws at UNISA. I taught at UNISA for 10 years. But today when I go to UNISA, I want to go to the law library. They say, are you a student? I say, no. So the law library is not accessible. Now, if judgments are not accessible, the law libraries are not accessible, it means the law access to even information on the law is not there. So if we can look at some of the things. And the thing you are saying about reliance on judgment, people say, quoting 1943 judgment, we have a similar problem, Honorable Zart, we have a similar problem. We are making an act, Attorney's Amendment Act. Now the law societies are still calling themselves Transvaal, Cape of Good Hope. Now, in terms of your thinking, are those names not overruled by already by the Constitution? Because the Constitution has the new demarcation. Now the suggestion is that we must go and consult with the law societies to align with the Constitution. Lawyers who should actually be in the leadership of transformation of the legal system are the ones that are slow. So we have all those challenges, but maybe that also gives us an opportunity to engage with the legal fraternity without imposing things on anybody, because once you impose the legitimacy of things, it gets questionable. But I can tell you, you made my day. I feel so happy because when we started, some of us felt that Parliament and government focused more on transformation of the judiciary, which has been done very well. There's a process, and I think things are unfolding. But the legal system as a whole was not addressed, and we thought that the minister is neglecting that. But you are common on the issues. Shows that you have been working on these things, you understand the issues, and as Honorable Maria said, I think you will help us also to drive this transformation agenda, and thank you very much. You have actually inspired us, and I can feel Advocate Mutunga feels like going back to the panel.
As long as I don't go through the Sakai.
The transcription. Honorable members, is there anything?
Thank you, Chair, for this one. Thank you for the opportunity.